offering my most loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet, dear listeners, I welcome you to this week's episode of the Gita series, A Triune Pilgrimage. As always, this is Prem, your friend from Team Radio Sai, coming to you live from our studios at Prashanthi Nilayam. For those of you who are regular listeners of this show, you're aware that this is a program where we go through the verses of the Bhagavad Gita. We try to understand the meaning of them and try to go a little more deeper into each of the shlokas in the context of what Swami has said on various occasions, and that's the endeavor. And as I've mentioned many times before, and as I've named the program too, it is a pilgrimage where we're all co-pilgrims. I don't share my wisdom on the show in that sense, that I know what the Bhagavad Gita is about and I am knowledgeable about this sacred text, and so I'm talking with all of you. This is more of a self-study, and I'm very grateful to all of you for being a part of it. That makes me more responsible, more diligent in what I'm doing, and I think we all can be grateful to Swami for this opportunity. We are in the second chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, and we've gone through about till the verse number 22. In fact, last week we covered the verses 20, 21 and 22. So before we proceed with the verses that we have for today, maybe we'll start with a short summary of what we covered last week. In verse number 20, Krishna describes the self as having no birth or death. In fact, all of the verses preceding that, what we've been covering the past couple of weeks, is about the description of the self given by Gita, by Krishna, to Arjuna, who refuses to fight. And in verse number 20, he speaks of how the self does not have any birth or death. And he says it cannot be killed. It does not get killed when the body is killed. Na hanyate hanyamane sharire. When the body perishes, the soul does not perish. Forget the idea of being killed. He says it does not even undergo change with time. Because even if someone is not going to kill us in that sense, or something is not, some event outside us is not leading to our death, we saw how time itself is the one which consumes everything, and the way time consumes everything is through the process called change. So Krishna says that it cannot be killed, it cannot be destroyed, it does not even change. So something which does not change, time cannot have any effect on it. So Krishna describes the self as sashvata, or changeless. And all of this nature of the self, Krishna says, is not an acquired status, or it's not a maturity that the self has come to. He says it is purana, it's a nature from eons. I mean, he doesn't say that there's a point where it begins. He says it is not new, it has not come today, or it is not something which has been acquired. In the next verse, that is verse number 21, Krishna kind of summarizes and reiterates the qualities of the self, and he says, so Partha, O Arjuna, the one who knows this entity to be avinashinam, indestructible, nityam, eternal, ajama, unborn, avyayam, unchanging, how can such a person kill or be the cause for someone to kill? Hantikam kam ghatayati. He says such a person who recognizes the self as all of these qualities, this nature of the self as being all of the above, such a person cannot kill or inspire anyone to kill. In other words, such a person does not be the doer. We saw how this works. This verse speaks of the importance of knowledge itself, and I explained how though this knowing is in the mind which is unreal, or the mind is asat, even though it is there in the unreal mind, it changes our status of being the doer of our actions and we becoming a non-doer. We saw how we generally interact with the world. We see through this mind. This is the mind through which we see all of that which happens in front of us. And the right knowledge, or the knowledge of the self, changes everything about the world, because the way we see the world completely changes. And that is the secret to be inactive even though one is performing action. And that is one of the most important things the Bhagavad Gita speaks about. Swami would also say that, you know, I am God, so are you, but I know it, you don't know it. So there is so much of importance in the idea of the mind knowing one's real self, right? So we might think that, okay, now I've heard all of these verses of the Bhagavad Gita, we've heard, you know, at least past 2-3 weeks, we've been going through that. I think we're going to do that even today. The verses today are also going to reiterate the same point, the nature of the self, and emphasize that emphatically. So one might think, okay, now I know it. Now I know that the self is all of this. It is eternal. It cannot change and all of that. So, you know, we're kind of good to go. We know it. If knowing is important, then I know it, right? But the very fact that even after this, Krishna had to, you know, give out about 600 verses of the Bhagavad Gita suggests that it is not the knowing itself which is not important. The mind is a very, very complex entity. And the process of completely sublimating the mind is answering all of the various questions and doubts the mind is likely to raise. That is in the intellectual level. And apart from that, of course, the process of living that knowledge, and that is what the Vedanta always speaks of as Shravanam, Mananam, Nididhyasanam. We are only in the phase of Shravanam. Reading and listening comes under Shravanam. Then to constantly ruminate over that through the course of life, through the various ups and downs of life, is the process of Mananam, and eventually that Nididhyasanam happens where this knowledge becomes spontaneous. So that is a long process. Merely knowing in that sense is not good enough, but knowing is also an important thing. Coming back to the Bhagavad Gita, the summary of what we did last week, in the verse number 22, we saw that it's a verse where the very famous analogy of the body being like a garment which one wears, and just like how a worn out garment is given up and a new garment is worn, Krishna says that the body, when it is old and when it is useless, it is given up and a new body is taken up. And that is the important verse, that is verse number 22. And in fact, we also saw how the fact that this body is impermanent and it is something like a temporary surface over the real self should give us a lot of peace of mind and a lot of self-confidence in doing what has to be done, right? That is the most important feeling that comes when you acknowledge and constantly remember that this body is only like a garment that we wear. In fact, we'll dwell a little more deeply into that analogy, because the verse which follows also derives from that analogy. We'll speak about that. But the verse number 22 is where Krishna makes this all-important analogy of the body being a garment for the soul. We also went through a particular discourse of Swami where Swami raises this point that it is understandable when you say that the garment is old and you discard it. Similarly, the body is old and you discard it. What about the cases where young bodies are discarded? We constantly come across that of young children, people in their youth or people in their middle ages dying. Why is that happening if only the old garment has to be discarded, old body has to be discarded? And Swami gives a beautiful explanation of how when we say old, it is not necessarily the aging of the body. It means a lot of other things. And Swami very clearly says that it is only the Dehi who knows when the utility of the body has been achieved or has been outlived. And so the Deha has to be discarded. So the Dehi knows. I mean, now when we're looking at it, we are trying to look at it from our mind, which is still not as wise as it should be. And in that case, we are looking at somebody and saying that, oh, this person has died young, or this person should have lived longer. Swami says that we are not the one to qualify that. The Dehi knows when the utility of a certain body has been outlived, and so the body is given up. So that's where we were last week. These were the verses we covered, 20, 21, and 22. We'll go through the verses which come subsequently thereafter. We'll go to verse number 23. As I said, it is in a sense a continuation of verse number 22. There's a certain idea which I left with last week, and verse number 23 takes off from there. But we'll first listen to the verse in the voice of Brother Shyam, who's very, very clearly recorded these verses for us. After that, I'll give you a brief meaning of that verse, and thereafter we will go into the inner meaning of that verse.
నైనం చిందంతి శస్త్రాణి నైనం దహతి పావకః న చైనం క్లేదయంత్యాపో న శోషయతి మారుతః.
Weapons cut it not, fire burns it not, water wets it not, wind dries it not. This is again a very classic verse, and you know, many people would have come across many people quoting this verse. It's a very classic, very poetic verse which speaks of the self as being indestructible. The last time when we were going through that verse number 22, I gave this example of a mobile phone and a screen guard, right? We spoke of how the screen guard being a temporary surface that can be replaced at will gives us a lot of confidence. We don't mind if harm comes to it. We don't lose sleep over it. Similarly, the body is only a temporary surface, and any harm that comes to it should not lead us to much bother, right? That's the analogy which I had given last time. But there are some things that can still break the screen, right? Say I drop the phone, the screen guard is not going to help me. It's going to still lead to a certain destruction or a crack on the screen, which is going to be a dangerous thing for me. Or going back to the analogy of wearing a shirt, yes, the shirt becomes dirty, I don't mind, but there are some accidents which not only dirty the shirt, not only tear the shirt, but it could damage the body which is beneath the shirt too. So what if there are things which can affect the self? Yes, the body is temporary, and any harm that comes to the body should not bother us. But is there anything that can cause any kind of damage to the dehi beyond deha? Right? That's a question which might come, which should not come, because by now we've heard enough descriptions of the self from Krishna where this thought should not come. But let's say that, do we have no reason at all to worry about the dehi? And we raise this question. So it's almost like a reply to that. In this shloka, Krishna explains, there is absolutely no harm that can come to the self. Na enam chindanti shastrani. Weapons cannot cut it into pieces. Na yenam dahati pavakaha. Fire does not burn it. We have defined the body or the deha as dahyate iti deha. That which burns is the deha. That is the nature of the deha, but the soul, na yenam dahati pavakaha, fire does not burn it. Na cha yenam kledayanti apo, it is not wet by water, na shoshayati marutaha, wind does not dry it. In other words, there is nothing that can happen in this world, in this plane of existence that we are all in, which can affect the nature of the self. Let's for a brief time go back to this analogy of the mobile phone that we spoke about. You know, when we talk about having scratches on the surface of the glass of the smartphone, you know, which is very interesting if you find out how they make this glass a little tougher so that it does not get any scratches, or what is the material they use in the screen guard and all of that. So when you're talking about a surface being scratched by some other object, there is something called a Mohs scale of toughness. Mohs is M-O-H-S. If you actually Google it, you'll come across that. Mohs scale of toughness is, you know, let's say I have a plastic. So depending on the Mohs scale of toughness which is given to that plastic, we can tell what are the kind of instruments or implements which can cause damage to this particular plastic surface, right? So it's almost like a rating of toughness which is given to different minerals or surfaces, and this is what is called a Mohs scale. And all those minerals and materials that have a Mohs rating which are higher than the object we are talking about can cause scratches or harms, right? So, for example, let's say that the regular glass that we have, be it the glassware which we use in dishes or the glassware which we have on a TV screen or something like that, this regular glassware has a Mohs rating of something around 5, okay? So metal objects like, say, knives and keys, which we usually use, they have a Mohs rating of 6 to 6.5. So which means these metal knives or keys, they can cause scratches in these glasses which has a Mohs rating of 5. But for instance, the Mohs rating of our fingernails is something around 2. So with fingernails, you cannot cause scratches on the glass. So I hope you're getting the point. That is, anything that has a higher Mohs rating of hardness can cause damage to something which has lesser Mohs rating of hardness, but that which has a lesser rating will have no effect on something which has higher. So nowadays what they do is, you know, they make this glass on the smartphone very, very tough. You know, a lot of other technologies which have come in, we've got Gorilla Glass and Gorilla Glass 2, 3, 4. I think now it's gone up to 5. So what they do in this case of gadgets like the mobile phone is they, you know, the ways of treating the glass in such a way that essentially raise this Mohs rating of that particular surface. So from a regular glass having a rating of 5, some of these specialized glasses will have a rating of, say, something like 7 or even 8. So which means all of these small things like your keychains, if you put a phone with your keys in your pocket, they will not cause any scratches to these glasses, simply because now the Mohs rating of this glass is a little higher. But interestingly, even these kind of glasses get scratched by sand because silica has a higher Mohs rating, right? Because the reason why I'm going to all of this is, the point I'm trying to make is this. Only that object which has greater Mohs rating can cause harm to objects with lesser Mohs rating, right? And objects with a lesser Mohs rating of hardness cannot cause damage to surfaces made of substances which have a higher rating, right? The reason why I'm making this, when I spoke about this, is a very, very similar thing happens when you look at the materials of the world and the self or the soul. The soul is sat. The material world is asat, right? That's something which we have come across. And within the asat realm, or within this world we are living in, there are varying levels of reality. For example, we consider the waking state as being more real than the dreaming state, isn't it? Why is that so? Because wakefulness destroys the dream. Similarly, the classic example of, say, the rope in the darkness. When we see a rope lying in twilight or dark, we imagine it to be a snake. And the moment we imagine it to be a snake, we start getting scared. But when we, say, shine a torchlight there, or when there is bright light shining over that place, instantly we realize that it's not a snake, it's a rope. And with that understanding, the fear that we felt instantly vanishes, right? It does not go slowly, or it does not say, you know, okay, am I sure that this is nothing like that. The moment light is shined, the moment the rope is seen as rope, the fear vanishes. Why is that so? The fear was based on an illusion, and with more light or more information, the illusion was removed and the fear that was based on the illusion also was removed. Similarly, some pains are not worth worrying too much about, not worth giving too much importance to. Why? Because they are short-lived, right? Or there might be a purpose which overrules that pain. Everything from, you know, why do we do exercise, or why do we take the trouble to sit in the office for long hours and finish a project, or a classic example of a mother who endures labor pain to give birth. Because these are all pains which can be overruled by a more important purpose. The purpose in the case of a mother giving birth to a child is, the purpose of motherhood overrules the pain that labor causes, right? The joy there overrules the pain. So within this asat world, that which is more real always can destroy that which is less real. Or that which is more purposeful or more long-lasting, more resilient, can break down all that is less purposeful, short-lived, and not as much enduring. But what is more real can only be covered for a brief period by what is less real. Like the dream state when it exists, right? When you're dreaming, you think that that is the reality. But the moment you wake up, you overcome that dream. So for a brief time, that which is unreal covers that which is real, but it can never affect the real in that true sense, right? So now when we talk about the soul, which is sat, which has no non-existence, as we saw, it is eternal, it is birthless, it is deathless, that which is less real cannot in any way affect this sat which is real. It is only covered for a brief period, just like how the dream state covers the wakeful state. So the elements, like whatever we've been speaking in this particular verse, fire and water, or the weapons made with the help of these elements like knives, arrows, swords, bombs, missiles, whatever, cannot cause any kind of harm to that which is more real than themselves. Take for example, you know, you're dreaming and there's a lightning. The dream lightning can only fall on your dream head. It cannot fall on your real head. There's a fire in your dream. A fire in your dream can only burn down the house in your dream. It cannot burn down your real house, right? Similarly, everything in the Asat world, in the case of Arjuna, the warriors, their weapons, the animals, these can only affect the Asat body, but not the soul, which is a Sat Vastu, right? So just like how a substance which has lower Mohs rating cannot harm a substance with a higher Mohs rating, that which is less real cannot affect that which is more real. The Asat cannot affect the Sat, right? That is the point which Krishna is making here. All of these things that you're talking about, the warriors and their weapons, these are all unreal, and that which is unreal cannot in any way affect that which is real. Or for a brief moment it might cover, just like how we spoke about the dream state, or how we spoke about the fear that comes from illusion of a snake being a rope being a snake. But all of this vanishes over a period of time. But interestingly, this particular description that Krishna is giving, it applies even to what we refer to as the sukshma sharira or the subtle body. This is not the ultimate soul, right? We are till now talking only about the dehi, the soul, which is the ultimate pure consciousness or whatever, the atman or whatever you'd like to call that. But all of this, what was said in this particular verse about the weapons and the elements not being able to affect, they cannot affect even what we refer to as the sukshma sharira, right? The sukshma sharira is, we'll go into that in detail eventually, I think it comes in the Gita. It is made of the pranamaya kosha, the manomaya kosha, and the vijnanamaya kosha, which is the life breath, or the life forces, pranamaya kosha, the mind, and the intelligence or the intellect, the vijnanamaya kosha. These constitute what we refer to as the subtle body or the sukshma sharira. So in simple words, you know, it is defined as the mind aspect of your body, right? So fire cannot burn my mind. It might burn the body, but it cannot burn the mind. It can only, you know, burn that which is physical. Similarly, if you splash some water on my face, you'll be able to wet my hair and wet my face. But there's no way you're going to be able to wet my mind, right? So in the same way, fire and water will not affect the subtle body. It can only affect the gross body. But the sukshma sharira also undergoes modification when it interacts with something in its own subtle realm. For example, anger, jealousy, compassion, and selflessness. That comes closer to the sukshma sharira's nature, right? So these can modify the sukshma sharira. Or something which is higher than the sukshma sharira's nature, which is knowledge, wisdom, what we're talking about, jnana and all of that, this is higher than the sukshma sharira, and that can affect. So there is a gradation here which I'm trying to talk about. That which is in the physical world can only affect the physical body, the gross body. And that which is in the subtle world can be influenced by what is subtle or what is higher in nature or reality than it, right? But of course here Krishna has not yet made that distinction between the Atman, which is the Dehi, or the Sukshma Sharira. He is only talking about the Dehi here. But you can say that it applies even to the Sukshma Sharira, what he's talking here. The other hint which Krishna has been giving through the previous verses, and especially this one, is, and something which is going to be emphatically declared eventually in the Bhagavad Gita, if this indweller cannot be split, if there is no birth, no non-existence prior to its existence, doesn't it again subtly suggest the oneness of all the dehis? Let's say you have a tree. From the fruit of the tree, we get the seed, and you know, when that seed is planted, eventually that seed grows into a plant and eventually it gives a tree. So technically speaking, the second tree was not there. It has come to be, but looking at it, it was always there in the seed, and the seed was in the fruit of the earlier tree. But in this case, there was a non-existence of the tree, and now there's an existence of the tree, right? Which means the new tree did not exist before, and it has come to exist now. And we have heard, I think, just in the previous word, that not existing and then coming into existence is not the nature of the self. It is Sashvataha and it is Purana, right? It is changeless and it is ancient. So a subtle suggestion that Krishna is dropping here is, there is only one Dehi operating through all the Dehas. There is no splitting of the Dehi which is happening. There is no splitting of the Atma or the soul which is happening, because the Atma cannot be split. It is one, it has always been one, and there is no way there is going to be a division, or there is even going to be an offspring of one Atma coming from the previous Atma, like a seed or a tree coming from a previous tree, right? So that's a very subtle hint which Krishna is dropping, and all through you will find this refrain. I think in the last week when we were speaking, in one particular shloka, I mentioned that this is a hint which Krishna is dropping. But as I said before, the declaration has still not been made very emphatically. It is going to be made eventually. But if we pay attention and read through these verses, it's quite clear that this is what Krishna is hinting at. So this is verse number 23, where Krishna speaks about the inability of anything in the physical world to affect this Atma which is beyond the physical world. We'll go to verse number 24, we'll listen to it, and then I'll give you a short meaning and we'll talk about it after that.
Acchedyoyamadahyoyam akledyoshoshya evacha nityasarvagatasthanuhu achaloyam sanatanaha.
This individual soul is unbreakable and insoluble and can be neither burned nor dried. He is everlasting, all-pervading, unchangeable, immovable, and eternally the same. Well, it may seem like there is enormous repetition in this particular shloka, and there's a repetition of the previous shloka too. For instance, the word Nityaha keeps repeating over and over again when the previous verses it was there. But as I mentioned previously, what Krishna is trying to do here is establish that real glory of the self, what it really is. And after all of this, you are that self, I am that self, we all are that self. And you know, we've been hearing the qualities of the Dehi, of the soul, of the self, the indweller for so long, but we actually don't get how glorious it is. You know, we might say, no, I get it. I've heard it all this while. I've read the Bhagavad Gita before. I've heard Swami's discourses before. But the truth is, we really don't get how glorious the self is, who we really are. At least I can honestly say that I can't. I mean, though intellectually it is striking a little hearing to these verses again and again, the fact is we really don't understand how glorious the self is, right? Because as Krishna had told earlier in one of the verses, he who recognizes the self as unchanging will not consider himself as the doer, right? That will be the most obvious fallout of this understanding being established in the mind. Right? If we really feel what Krishna has been telling all about the self in all these verses that we've gone through, there is no way we can be unhappy about anything, or there is no way we can be elated about anything. You know, you will look at your boss who is shouting at you and say that, but my boss is not the doer, why should I be upset with him? Or, you know, if you happen to win $1 million in a lottery or in the stock market, you'll say, I mean, what is there to be happy about? Because this is not worth celebrating, because this is not going to in any way enhance who I really am, because I'm Sashvataha, I'm unchanging, I'm Avyakta, you know, Avyaya, nothing happens that can change this soul. So if we really believe all of these things which Krishna has said, and if we've really got it, there is absolutely no reason for being happy, for being sad, for being inspired to do something. Everything will cease if we understand it. And that is why Krishna is repeating all of this over and over again, because it is not easy to understand the enormity of the glory of the self. So apparently Krishna is repeating the same words, but if we look a little deeper, what Krishna is doing is, he is explaining the grandeur of the self from various standpoints, and slowly, as we said in the previous verse, driving this idea of the self being one. It is not different selves and different dehas. The dehi is one. But this is explained through different ways. For instance, in this particular shloka, Krishna reiterates again that the elements cannot have any effect on this self, right? What is the activity of fire? If you take the element of fire, what is the activity of fire? Fire burns, right? So in context of that, Krishna says, adahyaha ayam. This cannot be burnt, which means the activity of fire cannot have any impact on it. What is the activity of water? It is to wet. Similarly, what is the activity of wind? The activity of wind is to dry with something which is already wet, or remove wetness. But here Krishna is saying, akledyaha ashoshyaha evacha. It can neither be wet nor can it be dried. Which means the activity of the element of water and the activity of the element of wind has no effect on it. Then again Krishna calls it nityaha and sanatanaha, eternally changeless, right? What is the effect of something if you happen to bury it under the ground, be it a physical body or even an object which is made of a metal or something? If you bury it under the ground, what happens? Eventually it gets broken down, right? The process of decomposition or disintegration happens. So the effect that the element of earth has on anything is, it eventually changes and breaks down whatever is there to its elements. So by calling the self nityaha and sanatanaha, Krishna is dismissing that the earth can have any kind of effect on it. And that is the importance of calling it nityaha sanatana. But the most interesting adjective, at least according to me in this particular verse, is the adjective with which the shloka begins. He says, achedyaha ayam. It is unbreakable or continuous. Fire burns, water wets, air dries, earth disintegrates. So the fifth element is space. What does space do? Space is what separates objects, isn't it? Space is what separates one entity from the other. I see my body and say, this is me. I see your body and say, this is you. Why? Because we are separated by space. But when I see my hand, my leg, my hair, I say all of this is me. Right? Because it is the same body. I don't see any space differentiating me from, or what I see as my body, from all of these parts. Right? Because there is no, the effect of this element of space is not acting on this body. But the moment I cut my fingernails, or let's say I go for a haircut, when space comes in between me and these entities, which were actually part of me till moments ago, they become separate entities. How do they become separate entities? Space comes in between me and them, right? So just like how fire burns and water wets, space breaks continuity. That is the effect of space on anything that is physical, right? That is what space does. And if the soul is not affected by space, it means space cannot break the continuity of the soul. In other words, the soul is all-pervading. And that is why Krishna says, sarvagataha. It is all-pervading. My body and your body can be separate because they are separated by space. My house and your house can be separated by space. If my soul is all-pervading, doesn't it mean that the same soul that is in me is in you too? That is the idea that Krishna is driving at. That's actually a weird statement to make, because the soul is not in me, though I'm saying that the soul in me and the soul in you. I am the soul, you are the soul, right? That's the whole idea that Krishna is trying to speak of. But you get the point what I'm trying to make. If the soul that is me is continuous and it is sarvagataha, it is all pervading, isn't it also the same soul that is in you, in every being that we come across in this world? that continuity of the soul cannot be broken by space, just like how fire cannot burn it, water cannot wet it, wind cannot dry it, earth cannot disintegrate it. Space does not act upon the soul and break its continuity. It is continuous, right? And the moment I understand my soul to be eternal, unchanging and omnipresent, it means every soul in everybody is one and the same. Right? Because, as I said, it is not the case of the tree giving seeds and that seed becoming another tree. That does not happen. That effect is not there because we are talking of continuity in space and continuity in time, because it is unborn and it is deathless. It is Sashvata, changeless. It does not undergo any modification. So we are talking about continuity in space and in time. So which means Krishna is saying that who is the killer, who is going to be killed? It makes no sense to say all of these things. And eventually, and the final thing Krishna says is, Sthanuhu achalaha ayam. It is stable and it is unmovable, right? And that's how Krishna completes this. Because to move something, you need space. Like right now, I'm sitting in front of this huge desk on which we have this console. If tomorrow I decide to move this console to a different place in the studio, I should have space to move that, right? Literally, that's what it means. But if I have something, if this desk is going to be from one end of the studio to the other end of the studio, and let's say it covers the entire studio floor, there is absolutely no way I can move this desk from here. I can't even move it 1 inch, right? So even to move, I need space. And that which is covering the entire space cannot be moved. So when you say that the soul is sarvagataha or all-pervading, it automatically becomes sthanuhu and achalaha. It is stable where it is and it cannot be moved. It does not have any movement at all because it fills everything. It does not have space to move. So this is a very beautiful and subtle shloka where Krishna says that the elements which belong to this physical world, and we've heard this many, many times from Swami, how Swami says the entire world is made up of the Panchabhutas, all the five elements, fire, water, space, air, wind, and water, and earth. Right? These five elements is what makes this entire world. And this world is unreal, right? That's what Krishna has been saying all this while. So anything from the unreal world can have no effect on this real Atma, because as I said, just like how we looked at the Mohs rating, if we have something called the reality rating, or what is real and what is unreal, only that which is less unreal, only that which is more real can affect the less unreal. What is unreal can in no way affect that which is real. So all of these elements and everything that is made from these elements, all that we talk of weapons, we talk of the ways by which one can harm each other, it is all through the effect of these five elements. So these five elements can destroy another object which is made of the five elements, which is the body, but it can in no way affect something which is beyond the five elements, beyond the nature of the five elements, which is the self. And that is the essence of this shloka, which is the shloka number 24. So we'll go to the next shloka, the shloka number 25. We'll listen to it. I'll give you the meaning of that, and then we'll discuss in deep about that.
Avyakto yam achintyo yam avikaryo yam uchyate tasmadevam viditvainam nanushochitu marhasi.
It is said that this is unmanifest, this is inconceivable, this is unchangeable. Therefore, having known this thus, you ought not to grieve. It's very easy to explain something which is right in front of you, right? Something which is obviously in front of you, which can be seen, which can be seen, which can be felt, which can be opened up and, you know, looked at from different angles. It's easy to explain. Say if you have to explain the working of a machine, or working of an engine, or even a body part, right? You can open up the machine or you can dissect the body and then explain the working of that system, right? In the beginning, the Gita starts with a description of all the people who have assembled to fight. We heard how Duryodhana gave a commentary of all the people who have come assembled and fought. We spent a lot of time speaking of each of those characters. And then later Arjuna gives a commentary of what he is seeing. And we saw how they are seeing different things. Arjuna sees uncles, grandfathers and cousins and brothers and all of that. But it is easy to give a description of what is directly perceivable in front of you. But imagine describing something which is more abstract or something which is not available to be seen or heard or touched right in front of you. You know, in physics and in science, we have all of these concepts such as tensors, topology, string theory, quantum physics. These are all very abstract. I mean, you don't see them acting right in front of you. There are no experiments by which you can literally see them working, right? These are all very abstract topics. They are literally in the realm of the mind. So it becomes a little more difficult to talk about and explain concepts which are not physically available in front of you, but have to be talked about using your imagination and creativity, right? And Krishna acknowledges that the Atma is avyakta, which means it is unmanifest. If it was manifest and obvious like the people who had assembled, it would have been very easy to explain it, right? But the self is not obvious, it is avyakta. So only a wise person can understand it. I may not be able to understand quantum mechanics, quantum physics and string theory and tensors and all of that, but there are definitely people who can understand it, and we look up to those people as wise people. They are physicists and scientists who are definitely wiser than us, because it literally calls for seeing something which the uninitiated cannot see. I still recall some of my teachers, maths teachers in school, who would speak about calculus as a painting that they are seeing or a scene which is in front of them. They would literally lose themselves in bliss describing how a calculus function works, right? They are seeing something which I cannot see or the rest of the class could not see. But it is in the realm of creative thinking or imaginative thinking. But nevertheless, it is possible to appreciate that if you are able to think in the similar manner. But Krishna goes on to say that but the self is not something that can be understood too. All of these abstract concepts can be understood, and so there will be at least some people who will understand it and appreciate it. But he says the self cannot be understood at all. One level of complexity is when something is unseeable. The second level is when it is unseeable and also very abstract. A much higher level of complexity is when what is in front of you cannot be seen. It is abstract and it is by nature beyond the mind itself. Right? And that's what Krishna is saying here. The self is unmanifest, avyakta, and it is also achintya or incomprehensible to the mind. And Krishna is saying all this after all these explanations that he has given. It has taken us a few weeks to go through all of these explanations. After all of this, he says that it is avyakta and achintya. To be real, it cannot be comprehended in its entirety with the mind. It cannot be understood. That is the nature of the mind. Swami would give a very, very beautiful analogy to explain this. He says, see, you cannot lift a rock by standing on the rock. Right? What a beautiful imagery it is. You cannot lift a rock while you're standing on the rock. Similarly, we are all standing on this earth. We can lift everything else that is lying on this earth, right? But we cannot lift the earth itself, because the ability to lift anything on this earth is based on the earth. Because we are standing, because we can put pressure on earth, we are able to lift. And of course, it also involves about our ability to lift. And that's what is the personal capacity to understand something. But the analogy is you cannot lift something that you are based upon, you're standing upon, right? Of course, technically speaking, if you're able to put a huge, humongous crane on, say, a larger planet, you can lift the earth. But the idea is this. When you're when your ability to do something is based on something, you cannot use that ability to move or comprehend what you're standing upon, right? Similarly, the mind is able to understand concepts. The senses are able to see because of this self. As you said many, many times, the Upanishads say it is the self is that which enables the eyes to see, the ears to hear, the mind to think. That is what enables all of these things to act. So using these, the mind and the senses and the antakarnas, you cannot comprehend the self in its entirety, right? So because I'm standing on the ground, taking the support of it, I can lift objects. So the self's true nature is achintya. It is beyond the comprehension of the mind, because using the nature of the self, using the effulgence of the self, I am able to think. So trying to understand the self is like standing on a rock and trying to lift it. If you consider it, the mind always senses things through the process of change or comparison, right? Let's say that today I get up and I say, today is a very, very cold day. Or I'm not feeling well today. I'm not feeling all right today. My shoulder is paining, or I feel a twitch in my leg. All of these things we are able to sense. This cannot be measured. Like, and suppose I go to a doctor and I say that I'm having a stomach pain. I don't think every stomach pain or every ache can be literally measured like that. I am the only one who knows that it is there, because I am able to compare it with a state that I was in sometime before, right? That's what I'm trying to do. Yesterday I was in ease, today I'm not in ease, and that's why we call it disease, right? Something which unsettles you. Pain is always a superimposition over a state of normalcy, right? Yesterday I did not have this pain in my leg, today I'm feeling the pain. So always it is about comparison, and comparison comes into play only when there is change. So the mind and the senses always act upon change. Only that which changes can be comprehended by the senses and the mind. Everything for that matter, you know, something like the process of carbon dating that we do to measure the age of an object. It is through change. You know, the half-life of carbon, I'm sure most of you would know that. So there is a change happening in that particular object, and my way of understanding it or to measure it is to measure that change. Right? So there is no way the mind can comprehend something which does not undergo change. But the self is avikarya. In this particular verse, he says it is avikarya. It does not undergo any change. It is changeless. So there is no way the mind can comprehensively comprehend the self. And again, Krishna says, avyaktaha ayam, achintyaha ayam, avikaryaha ayam, uchyate. It is unmanifest, it is incomprehensible, it is unchangeable, so it is said. Krishna again says, so it is said. He does not say that this is what it is. It says, it is said that the self is avyaktaha, achintyaha and avikaryaha. Uchyate, so it is said, he says. So Krishna is still placing his entire argument on the Shrutis or on the Vedas, right? When every time he says that it is said, so it is said, he's referring to the verses of the great sages and seers before him. He says, you know, if we were to believe whatever they're saying, that this is what it is, so it is said. So as I mentioned earlier in one context, Krishna is still in what we refer to as the Smriti mode. He's explaining things to Arjuna that are purely based on what is already known as words of Vedanta, right? And also all this is because Arjuna was trying to justify his sorrow and despondency using wise words, right? That's what Krishna said right in the beginning. You're trying to speak wise words to me, I'll tell you what is wisdom. I will tell you if somebody has wisdom, what will happen to their outlook. That's what Krishna starts off. That's how Krishna starts off this entire discourse, right? So he's talking about that wisdom and what that wisdom will do to you. So he says that, you know, Krishna is still referring to what is already known, as we have seen, be it Arjuna, be it Duryodhana, be it all the Pandavas, they've all gone through a certain process of learning and schooling where this is all part of it. This is all Vedanta and Veda, which is part of that teaching which is given to every child. I'm sure Arjuna is not surprised to hear all of these things from Krishna, because these are all general knowledge. I'm sure, you know, especially when they are brought up in being taught Vedas and Upanishads, these are all general knowledge. So Krishna is still making references to the Shruti and said that, you know, these are all things that you already know. But if you truly know, if you truly are absorbed in that knowledge, how you will behave is completely different. And having explained all of this about the self, Krishna says, Tasmat, therefore, evam viditva yenam, having understood this referring to the self, evam viditva evam, having understood this as all the above, na anushochitam arhasi, you ought not to grieve. That's what Krishna says. So if you understand the self to be all of this, what I've told you so far, all this description that I've given you, when you understand the self to be all of this, there should be absolutely no reason for you to grieve or sorrow. One point that is very important to reiterate here, I feel, is, you know, we all know that the idea behind this entire discourse of the Bhagavad Gita is to make Arjuna fight. Of course, when I say Arjuna fight, it is not, the fighting is not important, but to perform one's duty is very, very important, right? The entire discourse is meant to make Arjuna perform his duty. What is more important than merely performing one's duty? Yes, we all have to perform our duty, and I'm sure most of us are performing our duty to a pretty decent extent. Maybe 70-80% we are all performing our duty. But what is more important than performing one's duty is performing one's duty propelled by the right emotions. If we really look at ourselves, if we really look deeply into how we act and how we carry out our life, we will see that most of the time we are even performing our duty propelled by emotions such as anger, desire, fear, vengeance and jealousy. If we very honestly analyze our life, we will see this. Yes, we take care of our children. Yes, we take care of our parents. Yes, we are, you know, coming to the office and working diligently given the task given to us, we are working. But how much of the duty that we do is being driven by all of these lesser emotions? Just analyze for yourself what we are doing. For instance, we work harder because we want to do better than someone else, or we want to improve in our life. There is that not greed in a negative sense, but there is that desire to grow. There is a desire to have more things, right? That makes us work harder. That makes us seek that promotion. That makes us strive harder in the work that we do, or learn new courses and equip ourselves in manner which enables us to earn more. Or, for instance, we give the best education to our children. Yes, that is our duty. We are doing our duty by giving them the best education or putting them in the right classes. But analyze for yourself how much of that we are doing is based on, oh my God, my neighbor's son or my neighbor's daughter is getting all of these things. Compared to that child, my child should not be left behind. So there is that feeling of jealousy or that comparison which comes in. Or you say that, you know, if I don't give all of this, you know, my child will suffer later. So how much of that duty is based on attachment? You don't want your child to suffer. Or how many of us do things thinking that, you know, later this will benefit me? If I take good care of my child, ensure that my child has a good career and becomes something great, then this child will take good care of me. So how much of our duty is based on all of these emotions? If we really look at it, if we really honestly analyze that, we will see that most of us doing the duty also is propelled by these petty emotions. For instance, take what Arjuna has come to do here. All of this dilemma which Arjuna spoke about, the Vishada Yoga which comes about, is only in the battlefield. After he has come to the battlefield, all of this has come. If he had not expressed that, imagine that Arjuna did not feel all of this and he had continued to fight. Arjuna would have performed his duty, what Krishna is trying to drive home, Arjuna would have performed his duty, but how he would have done the duty, his entire action would have been propelled by anger, by vengeance, by the desire to settle scores with the Kauravas. So he would have done his duty, but he would have done it backed by these emotions. So that would make his performance of the duty less than ideal, right? So what Krishna is telling here is that yes, you have to perform your duty. Yes, you should go and do what you're supposed to do, but it is best done if it is backed not by these emotions, but if it is backed by the knowledge of the self. If you understand who you really are, if you understand the nature of the world you're living in, if you understand the self that is in each one you're interacting with, and then you perform your duty, that is the best way one can perform duty. And there's no better example than that than Swami, right? There's nobody who is established in that self better than Swami. As Swami would say, that what great yogis after hundreds and thousands of years achieve as samadhi, for a few moments, Swami would say that I am in that state all the time, right? And what you see me as interacting with you and all is only a charade in that sense. I'm always established in that self. But Swami did activity, right? Swami started institutions, and when he started institutions, he performed the roles. Swami started a university, Swami took on the role of a chancellor, and Swami did much, much more than any chancellor would do in a university, right? So in that sense, Swami was carrying out his duty. He became a trustee of a trust. He carried out his duty. But all the time, never was the performance of duty inspired by any lesser emotion of desire, of wanting to grow, wanting to spread. Oh, this university should become the best university in the world, or this trust should become the best trust. No such emotion was driving what Swami was doing. That is the best way the duty has to be performed, right? So we have to do our duty, but if it is backed with such self-knowledge, that is the best way it can be done. Krishna is saying here, Na anusho chitam arhasi. You ought not to grieve, right? Yes, none of us want to grieve. None of us want to be unhappy here. I don't think anybody will come up and say that, no, I actually want to be unhappy all my life. None of us want to grieve, right? But we fill our lives with materials and security in the form of earnings, in the form of friends and family, believing that only this will give us a worry-free life, right? So when Krishna says, Na anusho chitam arhasi, you ought not to grieve, we say, yes, we ought not to grieve, so let me go and earn a fortune through my business, let me, you know, have all of these friends, let me have as many contacts as possible, let me know this minister, let me know that industrialist. We are finding these ways of not grieving, but Krishna says, yes, you should not grieve, but your not grieving should be based on knowing the nature of the self. Evam viditva enam na anushochitam arhasi. Having understood the nature of the self to be all this, what? Unbreakable, unborn, infinite, eternal, changeless, self-sufficient. Knowing that your real nature is all of this, you ought not to grieve. Our happiness should be based on self-knowledge. That is what Krishna is saying in this particular verse. That is verse number 25. And with that, I think it's time to wrap up this week's show. We'll continue with the second chapter from next week. So dear listeners, do join me for the continuation of this pilgrimage into the triune pilgrimage in the Gita series. In a short while from now, you'll be joined by Brother Bishu for yet another enlightening session of the Vahini Satsang. I'll join you all again next week, 7:30 p.m. for the next episode. Thank you all for being with me. Thank you all for your kind words, which you send me very often through your feedback mails. We can only be endlessly grateful, infinitely grateful to Swami for giving us this opportunity, giving us the inclination to read and try to understand. Very, very little of what we read and what we hear goes into our mind, but at least we are ensuring that we are spending our time listening to the right things, and we will do that with the prayer to Swami, that Swami, we are doing the Shravanam, we will try as much as possible to do the mandanam. You please bless us that the nididhyasanam, or the absorption of all of these wise words into our mind, happens. With that prayer, dear listeners, I offer this humble effort at Swami's lotus feet. I'll meet you all next week at 7:30 p.m. for the next episode of the Gita series.